Bob, an alcoholic. So, why are we here? We're trying to work all these steps to hone ourselves into such a state of spiritual perfection we glow in the dark? Or are we here to do all of this so we can grow in understanding and effectiveness? That our real purpose is to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. To serve what Alcoholics Anonymous refers to as its primary, number one, purpose. And if you've been diligent in this process by now, there's been a tremendous shift inside you. It's inevitable. And the shift is that you are probably no longer your primary purpose. That your primary purpose in life is something greater than you. It's helping God's kids. And now your usefulness is based on the fact that everything about you becomes to bear here. Even the worst stuff about you becomes useful. The things that you've done in sobriety that you're ashamed of becomes helpful. Because you can bet whatever is you've done in your life that you regret and you're ashamed of, you're going to end up sponsoring someone just like that. And your experience is going to help them. And there's a rightness about it all. But yet at the same time, I come here such a self-serving. I mean, my primary purpose was me, and I don't want to do 12-step work. And the book on page 89 says the practical experience, and this is the practical experience of a fellowship of people who've recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body, the practical experience of Alcoholics Anonymous shows that nothing's like a big word, nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works where other activities fail. It works where everything else fails. When I was in moments in my sobriety where I was absolutely insane with resentment, as I found out my wife and daughter moved in with my friend, or I found out that one of my employees just had ripped me off for $250,000, or I found out that somebody else had died, on and on. I can tell you, in those moments when I'm full of fear, this is what saves me. I'm a depressive alcoholic. I'm very much like Bill Wilson. I came cut out of a very similar cloth. Bill Wilson was a depressive alcoholic also. He suffered from it. He found relief in it. In his story, he talked. I'll read this. It's such a brilliant thing. This is exactly my experience. I thank God I fell into the hands of people that just pushed me and kicked me and shoved me into service and alcohol. I didn't want to do it. People are telling me to go on 12-step calls, go out to the prison, go to detox, or help others. I don't want to help others. I told this guy, I said, don't you think I should work on me for a while? And he said, work on you. You've done quite enough of that. Stop it. Go help somebody. Bill says in his story, I think it's on page 13, if I remember correctly. Nope. 15. The first full paragraph. 5 lines down. I was not too well at the time. Now, this is after Bill's sober a little while, but not a long time, within his first year. I was not too well at the time, and I was plagued, as I was, by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink. But I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I have gone to my old hospital and despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough goings. That is exactly my experience. And I didn't understand for a long time why these old timers are pushing me to help others and do 12-step work. And I didn't work the steps out of the book until I was over 4 years sober. So I wasn't really getting a lot of, the best I was getting was intermittent relief from me, interspaced with just tremendous self-absorption and almost to the point of chronic depression and bouts of anxiety, almost to the point of panic. And I came home from work one day, and I had gone to two meetings that day. I called my sponsor, and I'm sitting on the sofa, and I'm just thinking, just sitting there thinking about my sex life. And it's how, do you ever think about it and have it look good? It never looks good to me. And I just, whatever I look at, I only see the glass half empty. I don't spiral thinking about me upward. I always spiral down. I'm thinking I'm spiraling into this abyss. And the more I look at my life and the more I sit there and think, the bleaker everything looks, my financial future, my job future, just, you know, it's not good. And I don't just get depressed. I drink of this and this emotional condition like I drank alcohol. I get in it so deeply at times where I physically can't, I get debilitated. And if you've never been to this kind of depression, you will not understand it. You get to a point where you weigh 1,000 pounds and you can't get out of bed. You can't get off the sofa. You are debilitated. That your emotions have become that dominant, that you're that self-centered that you can't even get up off the sofa. You're so consumed with yourself, and that's the way I was. And I was sitting on this sofa, and I just am sinking into this horrid, horrid, frightening depression, because I know in moments of desperation for relief in the past, I have drunk or taken drugs at these moments, and it's scaring me. And I can't even get up off the couch. And I look at the clock, and it's about 10 to 10 at night. And there's a meeting at a quarter past 10, not too far from my apartment, up on the strip at a chapel called Duffy's. And I remember thinking, if I could just get up there, maybe I'd hear something that would snap me out of this. But I can't get off the sofa. I weigh like 1,000 pounds. I'm debilitated. And I said a prayer and I made up my mind that somehow, maybe through an effort on my part and maybe through God's grace, I don't know, but somehow I got up off that sofa and I shuffled out to my car like a mope. I walked depressed. You know, I don't know what I look like in the mirror, but I bet you my hair looks depressed. I mean, I get depressed in every cell of my body. I mean, I'm into it, man. I mean, it's funny now talking about it, looking back, but I'll tell you, it's not funny when you're in the middle of that. It's horrid. It was horrid. And I get in my car and I drive up to the meeting and the meeting was right on the Las Vegas Strip. And it's this chapel, and right next to the entrance to the chapel, there's a billboard. You know how they advertise stuff? Well, there's a parking space underneath the billboard. Well, so I park right there, because that way I don't have to walk but a few feet to the door of the Duffy's. And I park under the billboard. Now, there's 100 pigeons that sit on this billboard. Now, they're going to decorate my car to fit my mood, I'm sure. And so I park under the billboard and I go into the meeting and I'm sitting in the back of the meeting, but I can't even hear anything. I'm so into me that everything in the meeting is so distant and far away from me. Nothing gets into me. Well, there's a guy sitting in the back of the room who's coming off a drunk. He's sitting right across from me, and he's in bad shape. He's sitting, and he's grabbing himself and rocking back and forth like he wants to jump out of his skin. Intermittently, he can't sit very long, so he gets up, and he's pacing back and forth in the back of the room like a caged animal. His nerves are so shot. You can hear him, the bathroom's right there. You can hear him going in there a couple times during the meeting, and he's dry heaving in there, and he's a wreck. And I have a lot of problems, and I'm trying to figure them out. And this guy's annoying the crap out of me. So by the end of the meeting, I'm not doing any better. I'm actually doing worse. Because here's what happens to me when I'm really depressed. I look out at the world, and I look out to see how everybody in the meeting's doing a lot better than I am. And I'm the miserable one here, and nobody understands me, and I don't say anything, but because I don't want to bother anybody. But I just, it's like some people, there's writers who their image of themselves is in the fact that they're a great writer. There's athletes that their self-image is in the fact that they're really very athletic. There's guys who are writer or musicians who, because they're great guitar players. Well, I'm a guy who suffers more than anybody else. But I'm the best worst. I am the best worst. I can tell I'm the best worst here. It's horrible. And the meeting, the subject in the meeting's gratitude. All of you have so much to be grateful for, and you don't understand my life. This is that uniqueness. Oh my God, that terminal uniqueness that comes with that. You know, I am the only one that really. And people, and your my ego is so intense. If you've ever been in a bad, like a depression like that, and somebody tries to cheer you up, oh, they're stupid. Because your ego wants to be right about how miserable you are, right? And I'm in this thing, and I by the end of the meeting I'm worse. I don't know what I want to do. I'm going to go back home and think some more. I don't know. You know, that's what I do. I stay after the meeting because you guys have told me you got to do service, and I'll do some service, and at least I'll be a guy who suffers but helped, you know. So I stayed and helped Charlie. Charlie Parker was the secretary of the meeting, and we had to put the chairs back in order for the chapel, and we had to clean up the trash and make sure the bathrooms were okay and everything. And Charlie and I are the last two guys to leave the meeting, and Charlie's locking up, and he's on his way to work. He works a graveyard shift at one of the casinos up on the strip, and Charlie and I are standing there, and we look out, and the guy coming off the drunk is laying on the ground in front of my car, curled up almost in a fetal position. Now, I'm going to have to step over him to go home and ponder my life more deeply, which I would have done. I'm pathetic, but I tell you, I would have done. I want to go home and think. I don't want to be bothered with nothing. But Charlie's here, and Charlie has a big mouth, and Charlie says, "Are you going to help this guy? I got to go to work. Are you going to help this guy?" I don't want to help this guy, but Charlie has a big mouth. If I don't help this guy, Charlie's going to tell everybody in AA what a bad member I am. And he knows my sponsor. I go over to this guy, and he's pathetic. He's peed his pants. He stinks. He's shaking it out. He's afraid he's going to go into seizures. We don't have, at this time in Vegas, there is no free detox. If you don't have medical insurance or have money, you're out of luck. And this guy is, and he's so inconsiderate, he didn't even keep medical insurance. Imagine that, in the inconsideration. So there's nothing to do with him except one of two things, and I've done them both. And one is to find a partner, and you sit with the guy. You give him a shot of vodka with a little bit of orange juice about every hour and a half, just hopefully so he doesn't go into seizures. Sometimes they still do. I've had guys go into seizures on my living room floor. I'm so glad that I got to experience detoxing people in my apartment. But I couldn't do that. The only other alternative, there was a county hospital. And because they got some government funds, they were required to take a certain amount of indigent patients without money. But they didn't like it. And they did not like alcoholics because all the drunks from the street ended up at the county hospital. And so they had this disdain towards alcoholics. And I had been down there before with guys. So I'm getting this guy in my car, he smells. I'm driving down to the county hospital, and I know what's coming. I've been down there before. They'll make you sit in that waiting room, and they'll take people that come in an hour after you because they would rather treat the what they consider the legitimately sick people than this self-induced guy who's sick, who's probably going to be back here next month anyway. And they got that attitude. And I've been there before. And I know I'm driving to this hospital. I know I'm going to be there all night. I got to go to work in the morning. I'm not going to get any sleep. I'm going to be tired. I'm going to have to go to that job. I'm probably going to get in a fight with my boss because I'll be irritable. He'll probably fire me, lose that job. That's a lousy job anyway. And I think to myself, isn't it bad enough that my life's crap? I'm saddled with this stuff too. Doesn't anybody else step up to the plate in AA except me? The key word's me. And I don't say, I ain't saying nothing to him. I'm just driving. Get down to the hospital. We park in the back and I take him in. We sign up on this thing at the window and go into the waiting room, sit there. And this guy's coming apart at the seams. He's in really bad shape. And the nurses are just ignoring him. And so it's just me and him. And he starts to talk to me. And he starts to open up to me. There was one point he started to cry as he told me about the remorse and the shame that he felt for the things he did to the people who loved him. He said he couldn't even drink it away anymore. He told me that for some time he'd been wishing he had the courage to kill himself. And then he really got me. He said, I don't know why you're wasting time with me. See, I'm not like you people in AA. I always drink again. And he's telling me about me. And in the wee hours of the morning, I started to fall in love with this guy. It was the most amazing experience. All of a sudden, I don't have any problems. All I want is what's best for him. I cared more about what was going on with him than I cared about what was going on with me. It was some time later that I realized what had just happened here. I had fallen in love with the me that is in him. A part of me that needed to be loved but could not be loved directly by me. I had to love it through loving you. By loving the me that is in you. And you know why I know that? I had a therapist one time that was very big on love yourself. She used to say, you gotta learn to love yourself. You gotta love yourself. She said, you know, the problem is you don't love yourself. She gave me this. I want you to do this exercise every morning. I want you to stand in front of the mirror, look yourself in the eye, and I want you to say over and over again, God loves me. God forgives me. God accepts me. I love me. I forgive me. Bullshit. I could have stood there and said that until the planet blew up and it would not have changed how I felt about myself. Not one iota. And yet in caring about you, it came back on me. Just like making amends to you came back on me. I never imagined that. They checked the guy in. They gave him a bed. I'm driving home and the sun's getting ready to come up. It's early in the morning and I'm driving home and I'm crying. But I'm not crying because I'm depressed. I'm crying because I don't know in my whole life I ever felt more right about everything. It was like all the planets lined up. It's like everything is perfect. I know exactly what I need to do. I know exactly who I am. I know why I'm alive. I feel the presence of God in that car that you could cut it with a knife. And it wasn't through prayer and meditation. It was through exactly what Bill Wilson talks about, through self-sacrifice and constant work with others. And as I'm going home that morning, I remember thinking to myself, I want to feel this way the rest of my life. It was very much the feeling, the sense I had the first time I ever really got high. You know that feeling when you really light you up and you think to yourself, oh, we are going to do this a lot. We are going to do this a lot. And I want to do this a lot. And that was the morning I claimed my primary purpose. And it was the morning I, all of a sudden the veil lifted and I understood. I understood why these old timers were been hammering me. Help others, help others, help others. They knew something I didn't know until that moment. They knew that no matter how depressive I was, no matter how full of myself and my own fears and worries, no matter how narcissistically self-centered and self-involved I was, that if I stayed in that venue of service long enough, one day you'd hear a loud pop as my head came out of my butt and I would actually show up in God's world. And that was the day I got it. I got, this is it. This is what Bill Wilson learned. Do you know when Bill Wilson, at many years sober, went back into depression, you know what was going on in his life when that happened? I'll tell you, I think it's an interesting story. I sat in Stepping Stones, and I sat in meditation, and I thought about his life and what had happened and what brought him there and what happened to him once he moved there. Bill Wilson's lit. He gets sober December 11th, 1934. He spends his next several years every single day, when he says in the book, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant, that's like constant's a lot, constant thought of others, their needs, and how we work for them. Bill Wilson helped other, tried to help other drunks every day. He went to Calvary Mission, Towns Hospital. Later, he went to Knickerbocker Hospital, and he'd go there every day, every day. This is really self-forgetting. And Bill was lit up. Bill was free from the depression. He's a depressive alcoholic. And he was amazing. And then because he wasn't working and he had such bad luck in that area, they eventually lost the house on Clinton Street that was Lois's family's. I know that just cut Bill's heart out to do that. He lost her family home. Because he couldn't pay the taxes or anything on it. And they spent the next quite some time, I think it was maybe 2 years or close to it, sleeping on people's back bedrooms and couches. And here's this debutante who the only thing she ever did was fall in love with this drunk. And she's following him into homelessness. And something miraculous happened. Lois said it was her God house, where this woman stepped up and gave them an opportunity to have this amazing, it's a beautiful house out in Bedford Hills, which was way outside of New York City. Back in those days, before the freeways were in, it was quite a trek, actually. And so Bill Wilson went from every single day of his life helping other drunks to living in this paradise out in the country, and he started to implode. He started to implode. But he couldn't say anything because after everything Lois has done for him, how could you say so? How could you say, I want to move back to the city and give this up? She was in love with this house. She loved this house. And he owed her big time. And also at the same time, Alcoholics Anonymous is starting to have troubles, and now Bill's the figurehead. Bill's not at Towns Hospital every day. He's not at the Calvary Mission every day. When he does go into New York City, he goes to the office where he's plagued by problems. He's reading the letters of the groups that are falling apart around the country. He's reading the letters of the people that are angry at Alcoholics Anonymous and how they don't understand what happened, why A was doing so good, now it's falling apart. And Bill's whole task was no longer of a venue that would relieve him of the bondage of self. And he put his time and his effort because he cared about Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill always saw into the future. People who knew him, and I've met quite a few people that knew him, they said that they never knew anybody that had a greater vision into the future than Bill Wilson. He could see farther down the road than anybody they've ever known. And Bill was always caring about the guys and the gals that were going to get sober 50, 60, 70 years later in places like Adelaide. He knew they were going to come. He knew. He knew you'd be here. So he suffered. He knew what the answer was. And he suffered the depression, and he wrote the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he fought with the groups. They wouldn't accept them. He wrote them in the original form, which is now considered the long form, and he fought with them. And once Alcoholics Anonymous was stable and the traditions were in place, Bill Wilson at the conference turned Alcoholics Anonymous over to its members, and he tried to go back to just being another drunk, helping other drunks. And the last years of his life were sweet because he got back to doing what he should have been doing all along. But Bill sacrificed himself for us. I remember sitting there and thinking about it, thinking, I don't think I could have done it. I think I'd have died in the middle of this dream house. I would have just been so consumed with myself, I don't think I could have survived. And Bill suffered from there's letters in our archives where friends of Bill wrote and to other friends, and they were in their letters, they were afraid Bill might take his own life. There's letters in the archive where Bill was supposed to deliver to Tom Powers sections of the book, The 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions. And the letter says, we can't get it to you. Bill's sitting in his desk sobbing. He's so depressed. And he muscled through it. And he got that book together, The 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions. He got us safe from ourselves. We owe a great debt to Bill Wilson. A great debt. He really gave his life for us. He never wanted credit. He never asked for credit. When Time magazine wanted to put him on the cover, he turned it down. Lois, who was always... Lois is so... I met Lois. Lois was so funny. Years later, I wasn't there when she said this, but... She's at some AA event, and somebody's saying, wow, Bill Wilson turned down the cover of Time magazine. He's the only one in history that ever did that. And Lois said, yeah, he did. That's true. He turned down the cover. Then she said, you know, but I think he got more mileage. She said, there have been hundreds of people on the cover. He's the only guy in history that ever turned it down. I think he got more mileage out of turning it down. She was very good for him. She was perfect. They were brought together by divine appointment. I don't think another woman could have bared with it. And we owe her a great debt. And out of this, we came an altruistic movement. I am a big proponent, and I run into people in AA that are doing, emotionally not doing very well. And I always try to encourage them. I got guys I sponsor that now sponsor 7 and 8 people that at one time were on lots of medications and very depressed. And they were basket cases emotionally, and they're free men. And you would not know them today if you saw them because of the way they laugh and carry on. I think Scott met Neil. We call him the admiral of our group. 5 years ago, he was so entrenched in the mental health system, there was nobody home here. He was so medicated. He hasn't taken anything in years. You should see him. He's the funniest guy you'll ever meet. He's just hilarious. And he sponsors guys. He does service. He has new guys in his car a lot. He comes to detox. He's alive. He's free. The Buddhists tell a story about a man who tries to ride two horses and how you can't. And you can't serve a power greater than yourself and serve yourself. You got to pick your horse. And you got to ride that horse. If serving yourself has worked well for you, I would encourage you to do that. But if you're like me, it hasn't worked out very well. So I would encourage you to ride this horse. It's the horse of self-forgetting. And nothing will ensure immunity from drinking his intensive work with other alcoholics. Do you know, in AA, I heard this years ago, and I don't know if these are accurate statistics, but they feel pretty close to me. Like they're not, I don't think if they're not, maybe not accurate, they're not far off. This trustee said at a service conference that 5% of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous does 95% of the service. And of that 5% that does 95% of the service, that 5% has almost a perfect recovery rate as long as they stay part of the 5%. When it says in the book, nothing so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics that are a kid, and it's really true. So I try to stay on the lines. I try to stay in the trenches. It's not convenient. I've had times where I could have done some amazing stuff, but I have a commitment to do this. It's easy to say that you really have surrendered yourself completely to the simple program, that your primary purpose is helping others. It's a little more difficult to live that, to actually day in and day out. You know, the book suggests that we ask God in our morning meditation each day how we can help the man who is still sick each day. Then we forget. In the chapter, Working with Others is a blow-by-blow description on how to do a 12-step call, how to sponsor someone. This is a lost art. I think if we followed this chapter more, we'd have more success in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we wouldn't be trying to recruit people into AA that really shouldn't even be here. We'll get into that. Page 90, top of the page. Okay, let's say you're buying this. You're going to go help people. Remember, Bill Wilson worked with 96 people who drank again before he met Dr. Bob. 96. So if the first person you try to help drinks again, you got 95 more to go through just to be up to his level. I mean, you keep pitching. There's a spiritual principle. You throw enough shit up against the wall, some of it will stick. Just keep throwing crap. Just keep throwing it, flinging it. Just keep flinging it. So you find somebody. You get your first 12-step call, top of page 90. When you discover a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, find out all you can about him. Which means you're going to listen to him. You're going to ask him some questions. You're going to seem like you're really interested in him and his life. If he does not want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. That's a very, do you want to stop drinking? No, I know you think you should. Do you want to stop drinking? Well, I know your wife wants you to. Do you want to stop? I know the judge wants you to. I know your boss. I know. But do you want to stop drinking? And it says, don't waste time trying to persuade him. You might spoil a later opportunity. I'm an idiot. I start doing 12-step work when I'm new, but I never read this book. If you don't read the book and you don't have the principles in place, then all I got to come with is my own personality. Right? So I'm coming to 12-step work with ego. I get a 12-step. Oh, we had this answering service in Vegas back in the late 70s, early 80s. It was a professional answering service that went on like at night. And during the from midnight to 8 a.m., there was a professional service that answered the phone. You call Alcoholics Anonymous. Get a professional service. They have a list of phone numbers. They call a member of AA that was willing to answer, take a call in the middle of the night. Well, what this service did is they don't call varied people. They find one or two people they know are going to take the calls, and they just call them. So I went through a period where I was getting calls every night. And I get a call. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. And
this is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is Bob. Do you want to stop drinking? Well, I'll be right there. I put on my cape. I get in my car. I put in my favorite soundtrack to Mighty Mouse, Here We Come to Save the Day. And I zoom over there because I'm going to get this guy sober because I need to bring him back to my home group to show the old timers. I'm almost like, you know, when your cat brings your mouse and shows it to you. You know, I'm like, I want to bring this guy and dump him at the feet of the old timers and my sponsor. Because it's about me. It's all about me. This guy, and I get these guys, well, at 3 o'clock in the morning, alcoholics will call Alcoholics Anonymous. I should know that. I used to do that. I don't want to get sober. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. There's nobody to talk to, and I've run out of vodka. I mean, I'm calling ex-girlfriends, for God's sakes. I'm calling suicide prevention. I mean, I'm calling anybody. These guys don't want to get sober, but I don't ask them because they called. So I get the guy in my car. I've done horrid things. I went one. Me and some gal went to some gal's house one time, and she asked for a 12-step call. I held her in the one room, wouldn't let her out of the one room. The gal held her in the one room, and I went in the bathroom and dumped out all her pills. And she's looking in her bottle of vodka. She's looking at me like, "Oh no, you know, like what are you guys? What a horrid thing to do to somebody! I'm dumping out their vodka and pills. But I don't know any better, right?" I'm not carrying the message. I'm carrying the disease. I'm contagious. Oh, God. I get these guys, and I tell you, they're going to get sober, or I'm going to kill them. Because if they don't stay sober, I'm going to look bad, right? And once you take them to a home group, and some old-timer seen you with them, now they can't drink again. Because I'm going to look bad. And, oh, my God, the book says don't chase a guy that doesn't want to stop drinking. You'll spoil a later opportunity. And I did that, and I got to tell you, I didn't do it out of malice. I did it out of ignorance. But when it comes to alcoholism, ignorance is as deadly as malice. And there's a lot of people, a lot of things I wish I could undone. There's a lot of people that I 12-stepped back in those days that may never come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I was the first view of AA they'd ever see. There might have been some of those people that maybe were this close to hitting the bottom and being ready for us. Maybe. And now they may never be ready because they had to run into Bob. And I'm coming from ego. It's all ego. That's all. There's an old Persian proverb. It talks about this. Why we don't do this? Why you don't try to get somebody to stop drinking that doesn't want to stop drinking? Why you don't want to change somebody that doesn't want to change? It says it's like trying to teach a pig to sing. Not only doesn't it work, it annoys the pig. I annoyed a lot of pigs, man. I didn't mean to, but I did. Okay, so what do you do if the guy wants to stop drinking? Good question. If there's any indication that he wants to stop, a good talk with the person most interested in him, usually his wife. That seems so bizarre to me. That might be true, though. I'm outside of his wife. There's nobody more interested in him than him. But that's what Al-Anons, we marry. You know why alcoholics marry Al-Anons? We finally find someone who thinks about us as much as we do. I mean... So you talk to his family members if you can. If he doesn't have any family members, you talk to him. This is very important. He says, get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his background, and the seriousness of his condition and his religious leanings. Why? To do the most important thing you will do. And the next line is the essence of what we do here. I think if you can do what it talks about in the next line, it'll make the difference between success and failure. You need this information to put yourself in his place, to see how you would like him to approach you if the tables were turned.
One of the most powerful things in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's given to us. It's not given to the psychiatrists and the clergy. It's not given to the doctors. It's given to us. Is this ability to do something that a man with 5 doctorate degrees cannot do and never will be able to do. And that is, if you're clear with yourself and you've worked the steps, if you're properly armed with information about yourself, if you get your disease and get the self-centeredness and you get it all, that you can go inside yourself to a place where you will get this new guy in a way that nobody's ever understood him before, because it's you. You are intimately familiar with his state of mind and emotion, because it's you. And you can come at him in a way that will blow his mind, because you're just talking to yourself. I think a good 12-step call is, I'm just talking to me. I'm talking to the me that I was, that I'm seeing in you that I was 34 years ago. That's what I'm doing. I'm talking to me. And the old timers were masters of that when I got sober. Oh my God, they'd say things to me that you just think they're psychic. How do you know that? And we kind of, because if you know yourself, we kind of have an unfair advantage, really. I mean, an alcoholic properly armed with information about himself not only can help another alcoholic, he can scare the crap out of one too. I mean, when you think about it, you take somebody who's brand new, sober 3 days. You can walk up to them and say things because they're true and you'll know. Just go things like, you've been worrying about yourself a lot, haven't you? How do you know that? Because we know ourselves. We know that. That's why in Alcoholics Anonymous we have singleness of purpose is so important. You don't have to come to AA and describe all your other problems. We know. You don't have to. You don't have to tell us you had a hard time with drugs. We know. We don't know anybody here that's had a good time with them. You don't have to say you're an alcoholic and you don't have to say you're an and. We know you've had a problem with relationships. Yeah, we know that. We know you think about yourself obsessively. We understand. We worry about stuff. We know. You don't have to say you're an alcoholic and a neurotic. We know. We understand. You're alcoholic and you don't fit anywhere. You don't have to say you're an alcoholic and I'm lonely. We know, we understand, we get you, because you're us. We get you. We have alcoholism, because when I say, my name's Bob Darrell and I'm an alcoholic, and if you're an alcoholic who's properly armed with information about yourself, at that moment you know more about me than any member of my family has ever known. You know me, because you know you. Powerful stuff. So if I can get clear enough of myself, and you know, the things that stand in the way of our usefulness, the stuff I talk to God about in step 7 is all the self crap. Like all of a sudden, I got a relationship on my mind, so I'm not really there for you. So now I'm blocked. Now I can't come into myself and go to that place where I get you, because I go inside myself and all I see is the relationship or the finances. Or the things I'm afraid of, or the resentments. So it's optimum that I stay clear of me so I can help you. And sometimes the one facilitates the other. The very action of my, and the very desire, and the word desire, oddly enough, comes from the Old English. It's 2 words, de meaning of and sire meaning father. The moment that I have a desire to be helpful, it's almost like that in and of itself can relieve me of enough of the bondage of self to become a channel again, so that I can go inside and do that thing that we do so well, that nobody else can do. So we're interviewing this guy. We're trying to find out, first of all, is he a real alcoholic? And does he know it? And we're going to have a conversation with him about drinking, about the queer mental twists. We're going to talk to him about all this stuff. We're going to talk to him about it. And he knows he's an alcoholic. He wants to quit drinking. And on page 92, after the interviewing process, Now, we're not taking him to a meeting yet. He doesn't have a right to come to a meeting yet. Matter of fact, we don't want him to come to a meeting. He'll just, what's he going to share at a meeting? What's he going to do? He's got nothing for us yet. He's got nothing for himself. So in the first paragraph 92, it says, after you interviewed him, it says, if you are satisfied that he is a real alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. Show how from your experience, how the queer mental condition surrounding the first drink prevents normal functioning of the will. We talk about those times we swore to ourselves we'd never drink again, and we did. We talk about our failures. We talk about our hopelessness, our powerlessness. We tell him. We don't at this stage refer to this book unless he has seen it and wishes to discuss it. The book hasn't entered into the deal just yet. It will quickly. Let him draw his own conclusions. Don't brand him an alcoholic. But insist that if he is severely afflicted, there may be little chance. There's little chance you're going to recover by yourself. This is not kind of good news for the guy. You know that? Goes on down a little further. It says, explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. And not only are you hopeless and you're not going to recover by yourself, you're doomed pretty much. And more good news coming up here. I'm supposed to tell you about the hopelessness of alcoholism. I'm a fount of good news for you. This is a lost art. We don't do that much anymore, do we? What do? We try to pat him on the back and tell him, oh, it's going to be good. And just don't drink. Your life's going to get wonderful. I watch this in meetings. Somebody will come back from a relapse. They've been relapsing for 5 years. And they've really broken down in the meeting. And they're sharing. They're saying, I just don't have what it takes to stay sober. I'm sorry. There's something really wrong with me. I'm so decrepit. I feel so hopeless. And people in the meeting will share at him to tell him he's wrong. You're not hopeless. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You just don't drink no matter what. What do you mean you don't? You have what it takes. We all have what it takes. We cannot drink here. That's a bunch of crap. Tell him the truth. The book says, hey, tell him the truth. You feel like you don't have what it takes to stay sober. You're right, you don't. You feel hopeless and like you're going to die. Oh, yeah, right again. Oh, yeah, you're good here. You're hitting 100 here. Good, good, good for you. You feel hopeless. Oh, you're hopeless. Yeah, you're just, tell them the truth. And you know why we can tell them the truth? Here's what the book says. We can talk to him about the hopelessness of alcoholism because we offer a solution. If we didn't have a solution, it'd be torture to tell a guy that. He'd just go blow. If all Alcoholics Anonymous had to offer was step one, we'd have a higher suicide rate than Jonestown. I mean, we'd all just inflict each other with the truth and go kill ourselves. I mean, but we can inflict each other with the truth about our condition of mind and body because we got a way out. We can tell you the truth. And you know, you need to know the truth because the solution is so drastic, it's not appealing until there's no option, right? That's the problem. If you placate the guy and you give him a false sense of okayness, you've just taken away his desperation. Explain that many are doomed. There's a thing that happened to me that I didn't understand for a while. There's amazing people in AA. I mean, amazing people who they know how to love the unlovable. Guys that are have no self-worth, that are actually have self-loathing from everything I've done. And yet at the same time have these tremendous egos that make it very difficult to help us. And men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous knew how to love the unlovable. Guys like me. They used to do things all the time for me. They'd give me, I remember one time I was in the halfway house. I just got out of the detox. So I was staying in this halfway house and it's kind of a down and out place. And there was men in Alcoholics Anonymous that would come over there and pick me up almost every day for a meeting. And they would take me every day to this men's luncheon, stag meeting, men's AA stag meeting. And it was at a restaurant. And I don't have any money. I don't have any cigarettes. Guys would give me cigarettes. That was back in the days when you smoke in the meetings. They'd give me a pack. Some guy come and give me a pack of cigarettes. I'd feel embarrassed. They'd buy me lunch. Sometimes anonymously. Sometimes I'd see who did it. Sometimes a waitress would just bring me a cheeseburger and french fries. Who paid? Don't worry. It's been paid for. Well, who? We don't know. We can't tell you. It's took care of. I'm getting a ride. I'm back to the Samaritan house one day, and this guy had come over and picked me up. He gave me a pack of cigarettes, and he bought me lunch. And, you know, I'm a funny kind of guy. I need the help, but I'm always ashamed to have to take it. I was in Japan years ago, and this Japanese person told me that in the Japanese language or culture, they have several different statements that they use to express gratitude to someone who helps them out of a bad situation. And every one of them, in a sense, would translate into the English as a type of resentment. Because if you bailed me out of jail, if you fed me when I needed to be fed, if you gave me a ride when I needed a ride, I lost face because I should have done that for myself. And I understand that. And I'm getting this ride back to the halfway house, and this guy, I feel ashamed of myself. I mean, I'm grateful for the lunch, and I'm grateful for the ride, and I'm grateful for the cigarettes, and yet ashamed of myself at the same time that you had to help me. And he said, and I told him, I said, listen, I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to pay you back. And he said, whoa, no, we don't do that here. But I'll pay you. No, I'll pay you back. And he says, listen to me. He says, you don't pay back nobody here. He said, what we want you to do is to stay sober long enough that you can do the same thing for somebody else that I just did for you. And I remember thinking to myself, well, yeah, okay. If I ever got a good job, and God, if I ever got a driver's license again, I don't think that may never happen. If I ever got a driver's license, I ever got a car, how am I ever going to get a car? I'll never have a down payment for a car. I can't ever get a car. But if I ever got a car, and I ever had a few dollars in my pocket, I would give some guy a ride to back a pack of cigarettes and a ride to a meeting. And I can say that with pretty ease because I don't think it's ever going to happen. It happened quicker than I would have ever imagined. And here's the amazing thing. I remembered the debt and I paid it forward. I don't think you can keep this stuff unless you pay it back or pay it forward. One or the other. You got to do something with it. Because my judgment of not deserving what he was doing for me was actually accurate. I didn't deserve it. And if you receive a gift you don't deserve, what do you got to do? You have to either pay it back or pay it forward. So in Alcoholics Anonymous, we pay it forward. So I started helping people. And there's a funny dynamic in the universe. This is a crazy thing. The universe will reward you with abundance in direct proportion to how much you help others. And it's a bad deal. It's kind of a bad deal because, okay, I don't deserve what you've given me. So I got to do service and I got to pay it forward. So, okay, I'm going to help these people over here. Okay, I'm trying to get even. I'm not going to get even, but I'm going to try to get even. I don't deserve what I got, so I'm going to help these people over here. Well, the universe doesn't care what my motives are. I'm doing service. I'm helping God's kids. So it rewards me with abundance. Well, I didn't deserve that abundance. I didn't even deserve what I already had. Now I owe more. Okay, so I owe more. So I got to do more service. Okay, I'm going to do more service. Now the universe rewards me with more of a good life, which I don't deserve. And now I owe more. It's like I'm locked into the worst loan shark in the universe. I mean, the vig on this stuff is very high. And you'll never get out. And you'll owe the rest of your life. And you'll live the rest of your life. You will live the rest of your life. Some of us didn't live any of our life when we got here. We were more dead than alive. My grand sponsor says we do it for fun and for free. In the 12 steps and 12 traditions, they refer to the 12th step as the joy of living step. There's nothing that lights me up more. It's one of the guys I sponsor, when he talks about 12-step work, he says, he'll say, he gets in a whisper and he'll go, "Oh, 12-step work? That's the good dope." I always liked the good dope, didn't you? That's the good dope. It really is. It really is. The book cautions us. If he's not interested and expects you to only act as his banker or a nurse for his sprees, you may have to drop him. Some people in AA, they don't really want help. They want relief. They don't want a sponsor. They want a fireman. Somebody's going to come in and when they've burnt their house to the ground, it's going to put the fire out for them so that they can go back to running the universe again. And sometimes you got to stop. You got to say no. My sponsor has a great line. If somebody asks him to sponsor him, and the guy won't follow directions, and he only wants him there to use him to his own relief, he'll say I can't sponsor you anymore. Why not? Well, because you're not sponsorable. You don't want me to sponsor you. You want a witness to your own demise. You don't need that. Sometimes we do guys a disservice by allowing them the delusion that they're sponsorable when the truth is they're not. And I'll tell you why that's a dangerous delusion. And I sponsor some guys that aren't sponsorable, but I'll tell you something. I tell them they're not sponsorable. I got a guy right now as soon as I get back, we're going to have this conversation. Because he's self-directed. And that's fine. I'm not in the job of trying to change people, but I'm in the job of being honest with him, and he needs to know. And the reason he needs to know is if he drinks again, I don't want him to drink again thinking that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work. I want him to know the truth. Hey, you never did this. You never finished your amends. You never made your service commitments. You never did what we did. Of course it failed. It didn't fail. You did. Because I want him to have the option of coming back and trying this again. If I allow him the delusion that he did AA when he really didn't do AA, what I'm really allowing him to think that AA, maybe AA doesn't work. No, AA didn't fail. You did. I want him to know the truth. So I tell him. Truth that people, we don't like, they don't like hearing it. None of us like. When I've been told that stuff by old timers and my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not like hearing it. But I know something. I know that these men love me enough that they care more about my life than my feelings. And I give them spiritual permission. Hurt my feelings. Save my life. Hurt my feelings. Save my life. And it's only when you're unsurrendered that your feelings can be hurt. You don't suppose that your spirit ever gets offended, do you? It's your ego that gets offended. It's not your spirit. Your spirit never can get offended, but your ego can. I'm going to read a couple things. I'll tell you something they didn't tell me. I'm glad they didn't tell me. I might have deterred me from doing some of this, but it's something happens to you when you do this. You start sponsoring guys. You start staying sober year after year. You start being looked at as one of the leaders of Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe you don't feel like you're a leader. Maybe you feel like you're just trying to get by like everybody else. But the newer people are going to start looking at you like that. And what happens when you're someone who sponsors people and does service in Alcoholics Anonymous? It's like you get a target painted right on your forehead. And people start taking shots at you. They don't tell you that. I'm telling you that it happens. Because there's two types of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's the doers and the judgers. The doers are pretty much too lit up and on fire with life doing that they don't have a lot of time to judge much. And the judges are too busy judging to do anything. And the judges will always tear down the doers. It's just the way it is. I worked on a lobster boat up in Maine. One of my geographics. I was up there and I was working this lobster. It's hard work. I was a stern man. I had to pull these traps. It's really a lot of hard work. And we get to pull the traps on board and you pull these lobster traps out. And often there's a bunch of crabs in the lobster traps. Now, these are not great crabs. These are not like Alaskan king crabs. These are just nothing kind of crabs. But they're in the lobster traps. And the lobster guys don't want them. They don't save them. So there's a bucket on the deck of the ship that's about maybe 2 feet high or so and maybe about 4 or 5 feet in diameter, maybe 4.5 feet in diameter. And you get when you pull the traps, you pull the lobsters out and you put the lobsters in the bins. And the crabs you throw in the crab bucket. And after a while, the crab bucket fills up with crabs. There's a lot of crabs in there. And I'm pulling traps, and I'm looking over, and now we're on the verge of having this huge deluge of crabs spilling onto the deck of the boat. They're climbing up the side of the crab bucket. There's no lid on it. And I said to the guy working there, now I'm a new guy on the boat. I don't really know that much, but I know what I see. I said to the guy, hey, you got to put a cover on that. And he said, no, you don't. I said, listen, you don't see this. Look at that one right there. He's ready to get out. He's almost over the lip of the deal. No, you don't. He says, watch. And I'm watching, and this crab's just about ready to get free. And the other crabs around him freak out and pull him back down. And no crabs ever get out. Very seldom do any crab get out of the bucket. And alcohol, you start to pull your head above the crowd and other people are going to try to pull you down. But we do this anyway, don't we? This is a tribute. This was actually written by a guy that's attributed to Mother Teresa. It says, people are often unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you will win some false friends and some true enemies. But succeed anyway. If you are honest and frank, people may cheat you. But be honest and frank anyway. What you spend years building, someone could destroy overnight. But build anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, they might be jealous. But be happy anyway. The good you do today, people will often forget tomorrow. But do good today anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. But give the world the best you have anyway. You see, in the final analysis, it is between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. That we do these things for the joy of doing them, not for return, not for notoriety. We do them because they light our spirit. There was a guy who was Bill Wilson's spiritual advisor. In New York, he was the head of the Oxford Group Church there. His name was Sam Shoemaker. And Sam, unlike a lot of the members of the Oxford Group, Sam loved the alcoholics, the drunk squad. A lot of people in the Oxford Group didn't. I mean, there was a little bit of a spiritual superiority in some of the Oxford Group. Frank Buckman, the founder of Moral Rearmament, the Oxford Group, was always at odds with Bill Wilson. Frank Buckman was always pushing Bill Wilson to go down to the captains of industry in Wall Street and try to bring them and testify to them, bring them into the Oxford Group that would swell his power base and his coffers. And Wilson didn't want to do it. Wilson wanted to go down and work with the homeless guys, the guys at the Calvary Mission, the guys in Towns Hospital, the dregs of the earth. And a lot of the Oxford Group didn't. They thought that spirituality should come with abundance. And Bill Wilson didn't care about any of that. He cared about alcoholics. He cared about guys like you and me. And so he went down into the trenches And he did the self-sacrifice. He did it all. And Sam watched him for years. And Sam wrote this poem, I suspect, because of what he saw Bill and the early members of AA do. And most of you have heard it. I've been reading this now for 25 years. It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen written. It describes us. It describes what we do here. It's called I Stand by the Door. I stand by the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It is the door through which men walk when they find God. There's no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside, and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where a door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched, groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door to God. The most important thing any man can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that clicks and opens only to that man's touch. Men die outside the door, as starving beggars die on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter. They die for want of what is within their grasp. They live on the outside of it. They live there because they have not found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping them to find it and open it and walk in and find him. So I stand by the door. Go in, great saints. Go all the way in. Go way down into the cavernous cellars and way up into the spacious attics. It is a vast, roomy house, this house where God is. Go into the deepest of hidden casements of withdrawal, of silence, of sainthood. Some must inhabit those inner rooms and know the depths and heights of God and call outside to the rest of us how wonderful it is. Sometimes I take a deeper look in. Sometimes I'll venture in a little further, but my place seems closer to the opening, so I stand by the door. There's another reason I stand there. Some people get partway in and they become afraid, lest God in the zeal of his house devour them. For God is so very great, and he calls all of us. And these people feel a cosmic claustrophobia, and they want out. Let me out, they cry, and the people way inside only terrify them more. Somebody must be by the door to tell them that they are spoiled for the old life. You see, they have seen too much. For once you taste God, then nothing but God will do anymore. Somebody must be watching for the frightened who seek to sneak out just when they came in to tell them how much better it is inside. The people too far in do not see how near these are to leaving, for they're so preoccupied with the wonder of it all. Somebody must watch for those who have entered the door but would like to run away. So for them too, I stand by the door. I admire the people who go way in, but I wish they would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who have not yet even found the door, or the people who want to run away from God. You can go in too deeply and stay too long and forget the people outside the door. As for me, I shall take my old accustomed place near enough to God to hear him and know that he is there, but not so far from men as to not hear them and remember that they are there too. Where? Outside the door. Thousands of them. Millions of them. But more important for me, one of them, two of them, perhaps 10 of them, whose hands I am intended to put on the latch. So I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. I'd rather be a doorkeeper, so I stand by the door. Samuel Moore Shoemaker. That is what we do here, isn't it? Men and women who are awake, properly armed with information about themselves, have their eyes and ears open, and they look for guys like us. As we walk into our first meeting, They give them their time and their energy, and they come into detoxes and they go to jails because that is more important than their very lives. They know. And I will owe my life to those men and women who came into the detoxes in the county jails when I was there. And I wasn't ready to hear you. And they didn't care. They just knew that if they kept coming to places like that, one day they would catch a guy like me. And in 1978, they did. And what would have happened to me if they'd stopped coming? What would happen to you? What would happen to your children's children if people stopped stepping up? So we step up here. We do it for the freedom. We do it for the fun, and we do it for the joy. We do it for the love. We do it because it's the best thing we've ever known. Alcoholics Anonymous will always be an altruistic movement.